Okay, with this split show, we are now going to talk about secret societies with James Wasserman, the Temple of Solomon. Get ready for this one. You'll love it on Coast to Coast AM. James Wasserman is a lifelong student of spiritual development. His writings, editorial efforts maintain a focus on spirituality, creative mythology, secret societies, history, religion, politics, of course, an admirer of the teachings of Aleister Crowley. Here's James Wasserman as we talk about his work, The Temple of Solomon. James, how are you?
Good morning, George. I'm excellent. How are you?
Good. It's good to have you with us. Fascinating subject. Fascinating.
Thank you so much.
How did you get interested in it?
Well, the Temple of Solomon is essentially the root of everything that has to do with secret societies and Western occultism. It is the archetypal symbol of the interaction between, you know, man and God, and it's the presence of God on earth, and that is really the goal of the secret society. In other words, how to bring the spiritual and the divine within our own hearts and minds right here on earth. So that's what happened with the temple.
Let's talk about the temple a little bit. How was it built? When was it built?
It was built about 975 BC. It was completed in 957. It was built by King Solomon, who was the son of King David, the slayer of Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
And it was built on direct commands and a plan that God had laid out actually to David, according to the story. And it was very much the development of the tabernacle that Moses and the Jews had used through their wanderings, the 40 years of wandering through the desert on their way from the slavery of Egypt to the freedom of the Holy Land.
James, did the temple have any mystical properties to it?
Well, absolutely, George. The most important being that it held the Ark of the Covenant, and that was the home of the two tablets of the law that had been dictated to Moses, inscribed by God on Mount Sinai, and was the talismanic treasure of the Jewish people and the symbol of the law of God and the interaction with God and his people.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the structure of it. Do we know how it was built physically?
Well, it was built with cedars, cedar wood from Lebanon, stones that had been quarried nearby and actually cut and shaped before they were brought up to Mount Moriah itself, because there was not supposed to be any sound or chipping away on the temple site itself. So the stones were brought there, fitted into place, and then covered with wood on the inside, and the wood was then overlaid with gold. It was apparently a really magnificent structure, rather small in its own way, but it was, you know, it must have just been magnificent.
What happened to it?
It was destroyed in about 585 by the Babylonians. It had lasted about 400 years. You know, the Bible explains that the Jews had walked away from the teachings of the Lord and brought enough sin on themselves that they were conquered by the invaders. And they were taken into captivity, brought to Babylon, and then about 70 years later, the Persians conquered the Babylonians.
Okay, and now, when you had mentioned the Ark of the Covenant and that it was stored there.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant was stored within the Holy of Holies, within the sacred part of the Temple of Solomon.
Where did it go? You know, we've heard all kinds of things that it's hidden in a church in Ethiopia. Who knows? But what's your take?
Well, my take, very frankly, is that we simply don't know. And it was, according to, you know, some of the apocryphal writings, it was hidden by Jeremiah, who is a prophet at the time of the destruction of the temple, and hidden in the mountain where Moses actually died and was buried, Mount Nebo. Other people feel that it was actually buried below the Temple Mount in some of the caves that are there to this day. Others, as you say, suggest that it was taken to Ethiopia. And, of course, Raiders of the Lost Ark had it in a warehouse.
That's right. Sure did. And it did have its properties, didn't it?
Indeed it did.
All right. How does this temple tie itself into secret societies?
Well, the idea is that it was a center of wisdom. You know, what is it that the temple really represents? You know, it represents a plan communicated by God, a kind of higher wisdom available to human beings, not something that's, you know, reserved for heaven or the afterlife, but something that, you know, a person could walk into, sit down in, and literally commune with the Lord. That is what I think is the essence of the mystical secret society. It's the idea that there are techniques available to us as human beings that allow us to enter into divine consciousness, and the temple is the symbol of that.
Let's talk about secret societies. Give us a definition, your thoughts on that.
Well, secret societies are essentially, you know, you could say that they started in the most primitive, prehistoric societies on Earth, when boys were brought into puberty and girls the same, and the men taught the boys how to be men, and the women taught the girls how to be women. Secret societies convey a tradition. They convey a teaching that makes people better people or more knowledgeable people, and they're designed to lead people through a series of challenges into a higher state of consciousness.
Why would somebody join a secret society?
George, we're talking about mystical secret societies. Obviously, there are other kinds as well.
Would you put the Masons in that category, James?
I certainly would.
Okay.
Certainly would. The people who are looking for what they can find in mystical secret societies are aspirants. They're people who are seeking a higher wisdom, and they're seeking a group of people of similar ideas and similar interests, and they're seeking to learn what the other people know and to share and discuss and have a kind of camaraderie with others who are on the same path.
Okay, so it doesn't necessarily mean that they're up to no good, right?
Well, one hopes. I mean, I've been a member for 36 years, I guess, of one secret society, and I sure hope I'm up to some good.
I always learned a long time ago, James, that if you're hiding something, if it's a secret, you might be up to something. So what do they have to hide?
Well, remember, George, that the ideal, it goes back, the mythology goes back to a time when people with alternate spiritual beliefs were literally hunted down and killed. I mean, we're talking about the Inquisition. We're talking about the times of the Knights Templars who were burned at the stake for what was imputed to be their beliefs. We're looking at a time when there was a religious and political domination that forced people to go underground. And now today, you know, the times are supposedly more free. So what are the secrets that one really learns in a secret society? Well, you know, frankly, it's not a whole lot. I mean, you learn handshakes and you learn little signals and signs and words and passwords. And the real secrets are something that can never be discussed or profaned. They're what happens within the human heart and within the psyche.
What do they get out of it?
They get out of it a certain
camaraderie.
You know, it's a special interest group. You know, you think of people who are interested in gardening get together with other gardeners.
So it's like the gardening club, but that's visible. It's very, you know, you see that.
Well, you certainly do, but you're not attending their meetings.
No.
You know, you're not sitting there as they're explaining how they spent 6 months growing or developing a certain kind of seed pattern. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are secrets that people who have a real focus on certain issues are keeping to themselves and sharing with others of like mind, because they're the only other people prepared to hear these kind of truths.
Would AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, be like a secret society?
It's funny that you mention that. I actually consider it to be that in a certain sense. There are a group of people who are united by a certain ideology. They are speaking a certain language. They are sharing certain ideals between themselves that are very relevant to them and perhaps far less relevant to other people. And they're open to people who suffer from a specific malady or who are looking for a certain kind of cure, a certain kind of knowledge, the knowledge to stay sober and lead happy lives.
How many societies, secret societies, do you think there might be operating right now around this planet?
Well, there are probably literally thousands. I mean, when you really think about it, I mean, there are Golden Dawn societies, there are Wiccan groups, there are all kinds of groups devoted to various teachings. And, you know, when I say secret societies, I mean, is a Gurdjieff group who is studying that teaching secret? Well, in the sense that, you know, they're open to people who are very familiar with Gurdjieff's writing, of course they're secret. They're not open to the general public. It's not like they're advertising in the New York Times.
No, that's true. That's a good point. How powerful are they, generally?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are political secret societies that I think are probably quite powerful. The Bilderbergs, the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, some of the secret cabals of bankers and Media Matters, for that matter. They're pretty strong influencers of you know, this social dialogue, the political dialogue. Spiritual secret societies, I think, are looking for knowledge. And if knowledge is power, then spiritually one hopes there is a great deal of power within the society. But whether they're really influencing the exchange rate or the price of gold or gasoline, I don't believe that's the case.
When we talk about the Illuminati, people always want to know who they are. Who are they?
Well, the question that I would ask is, who were they? What the Bavarian Illuminati, at least, were a group founded in 1776 that lasted about 10 years in Germany, and they were quashed by the government of the time. Now, they had some surviving members and some doctrines that went on to create vast political changes in the French Revolution, I believe. But whether the Illuminati exists today or not is really an open question. Certainly the Bavarian Illuminati do not. Obviously, there are influences at work in this world that are secret and that follow the kinds of teachings that the Illuminati were interested in, but I don't believe there's any sort of surviving tradition. I think the Illuminati were a mystical slash political secret society of the day.
Would you equate them with today's version of the Bilderbergs?
No, because I think they really work much more within Masonic and spiritual secret societies. They illuminized a certain teaching. The Bilderbergs are, I think, devoid of a spiritual goal or message. There are certainly no candlelit ceremonies or incense burning in temples. I think the Illuminati actually were doing that because they were working throughout Masonic lodges, and a great deal of the influence that went into the French Revolution was this kind of, you know, combination of magical and philosophical and political ideology that was represented by the Enlightenment and the kind of conspiratorial guidelines of the Enlightenment.
James, did you ever see Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut?
You know, I saw some of it, and I found it a little tedious. I have a little problem with time. Tom Cruise, God help me. I wish I didn't, but I do.
Oh, well, I had to see it three times before I began to understand it. But to me, that's perfect example of the Illuminati. These kinds of people who have more money than God, who just, they're bored with things, so they do these bizarre things, whatever they may be. But that's them. And I think that was a perfect example. And I think they're out there now controlling things. I think they're very, very powerful people. I think they run the world.
Well, you know, the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, were working against a tyranny. They were fighting injustice, and I think it's important to realize that, you know, this group of kind of bored, affiliated, wealthy people looking for political control is very different than the Illuminati. They were dealing with a system of church and state that was a literal tyranny, where an aristocracy controlled all of the wealth of European society, and they did it through a pernicious interest through the veil of religion, so that people were literally held back and thwarted in every one of their goals by a tyranny. And I think the Illuminati were free thinkers who tried to burst out of the chains that held people back. There was an incredible poverty that was going on prior to the French Revolution that, you know, is generational poverty that was horrific, you know, filth and ill health and a vast social inequities that, you know, we talk about those things today, but we have no idea what we're talking about. The Illuminati fought that. They were conspiratorial. You know, they pretended to be one thing and were actually something else, but they really did bring a certain light to the European society of the time. The kind of thing that you're looking at, the cynical, sarcastic, dark, like you said, bored group of people, that's different. That, I think, is a far more sinister aspect than what the Illuminati were. I don't agree with that.
Okay, but some of these members now, whatever they may be, they're pretty dangerous, don't you think?
Well, absolutely. I mean, all you have to do is open up a newspaper or listen to a television. Sure. Horrible. Just horrible. But not the Illuminati. There was a spiritual message with the Illuminati. I disagree with some of the things that they believed in, but I do respect the fact that they were trying to do something that was really bringing about spiritual liberty and political liberty. They were part of a culture that in its own way brought about the American Revolution as well, which I see a tremendous distinction between that and the French Revolution, but it was still, they were within 10 or 11 years of one another. And, you know, it was a time of vast social and political change, and, you know, a lot of liberation was taking place in the late 18th century, and the Illuminati were a big part of it.
Skull and Bones, secret society?
Yeah, but not. I don't see it as a mystical secret society. I see it more as the kind of political secret society that we're talking about with the Eyes Wide Shut stuff. Yeah, I do see it that way. Wealthy people bringing a certain kind of political domination through finance, through electoral politics. Yeah, I do see it that way. Media.
All right, James, and when we come back, let's get your take on Aleister Crowley, the great occultist and mystic, died in 1947. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I think it was Ozzy Osbourne who sang the song Mr. Crowley. We're going to talk about Aleister Crowley in a moment with James Wasserman, as we talk about his work, The Temple of Solomon, next on Coast to Coast AM. James Wasserman with us. James, if your book, The Temple of Solomon, was made out of gold, do you know how much that would be worth? This has got to be one of the heaviest books I've ever held.
You noticed. It was supposed to be a lot smaller, George. It was supposed to be 160 pages, and it was supposed to have been completed in 18 months. I'm afraid I really fell into the rabbit hole with that one, and it's turned out to be 384 pages and took 5 years of writing and research, including a trip to Israel and to Egypt. So it so far exceeded any of my own expectations or those of my publisher. I'm so thrilled that Inner Traditions was kind enough to let me kind of get away with that, because they were very, very supportive.
And it's big, not only in weight, but in size.
Indeed. It's just loaded with photographs. I was so fortunate to be able to take as many photos as I did, because by going to Israel and being able to see these sites one by one that are mentioned in the Bible, and be able to take these fabulous color photos and fill it with also just so much classical art and other drawings and stuff. It's just a visual feast. It's absolutely a joy.
Now, you're an admirer of the teachings of Aleister Crowley. I would not have suspected that of you. He was weird, wasn't he?
Well, he certainly was. And I mean, I guess in my own way I am too. But, you know, we all come to these things in our own ways. He spoke to my soul at such a young age. I was 19 or something when I really encountered him for the first time. And, you know, I've never found a more intelligent, more creative, more thoughtful teacher. And I've looked around a lot. I worked at Weiser's bookstore for many years, so I was really part of the kind of, you know, occult renaissance that took place through the 70s. I knew a lot of people and was exposed to many, many, many different teachings. Indian, Hindu yogis and you know, Taoists and all kinds of Sufis and Christian mystics and Golden Dawn people and just about everybody you could look at. Tibetan Buddhists, I was deeply involved with that. I had some experience with Voodoo and Santeria. I really had a very wide-ranging exposure to the occult. And Aleister Crowley just, somehow or other, I always came back to him.
Well, a lot of people have confused Aleister Crowley with Anton LaVey, who was a Satanist. Big
also,
difference.
Yeah, there was a huge difference. And Anton LaVey, you know, God help him, he certainly was not a...
Or the devil help him.
Yeah. Certainly not what you would call an intelligent guy. I mean, he was very street smart, and, you know, he was very powerful, but he was, you know, he was a carnival kind of guy. And you know, he didn't really have some philosophical teachings. The philosophy he expressed was well expressed for what it was, but it was very simplistic. Crowley was a world teacher. Crowley brought through a message that was of the level of importance, I personally believe, you know, to the revelation of Christ. I mean, you know, I look at Crowley, I sort of buy the whole thing, soup to nuts. You know, I look at him as the logos of the eon, the prophet of the new eon. I'm one of those guys, you know.
Well, and he was, though, an occultist, and deeply so, wasn't he?
He was absolutely one of the most knowledgeable and brilliant occultists in the entire human history. I mean, he had an understanding, an in-depth understanding of the meaning of magic and spirituality and the spiritual quest that I believe is second, in my experience at least, second to none. He was schooled in every facet of the Western mystery tradition, from the Kabbalah to Hermeticism to alchemy, astrology, and he wrote Tarot. He wrote brilliantly in each of these fields, and you know, he was a magician of the highest level of skill, and at the same time, he fused yoga and the spiritual practices of the East with the magical practices of the West. So he really taught people how to gain power. Because believe me, you can do all these rituals and run around in your magical circle and invoke your head off. But unless you have the ability to concentrate and focus the mind, your rituals and your magical efforts will be, you know, rather hapless. Crowley brought power to magic, and for that, I think we have a lot to thank him for, really.
Well, I think we do. Now, let's talk about his message, though. What did he try to get us all to understand?
In my estimation, George, what he tried to get us all to understand is that we have a destiny on Earth. We each have a purpose. It's unique to each one of us, and our entire job as human beings on this Earth is to learn what our true will or true destiny is and to do it to the exclusion of everything else, to avoid temptation, to avoid distraction, to focus on what it is that is our purpose on Earth. I think that he told us to think outside the box. He taught us to be free in our thought, to experiment in the ways of acquiring knowledge, weighing and testing every idea against itself, against its opposite. He taught that people were capable of making decisions once they had the facts, but without facts and without thought and without independence, people were slaves, and it was not the human destiny to be a slave. In fact, it's the human destiny to be a free agent, a free spirit, a free-thinking individual, making our own decisions, being our own source of power, cooperating with other people, loving other people, being focused and concerned with other people, but freely pursuing that which he called the true will. When Crowley told us, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, what he meant to say to us is that we each have this will, we have this purpose, we have this point of view that is uniquely ours, and the entire law, the whole purpose of human existence is to learn what that is and do it to the best of our abilities.
Well, he died at an age relatively young, in 1947 he passed away, didn't he?
Well, he was 72. You know, I guess it's young by today's standards, but...
It was probably old then, I guess, then.
Yeah, you know, that's... He lived a full life. He was a mountaineer, he was an athlete, he was a world traveler, he had been to China, India, Egypt. He was really, you know, kind of all over the place. And throughout Europe, spent a great deal of time in America, traveled to Canada. He had quite an illustrious career, really. He was a mountaineer. A lot of people don't realize that he held for a long time the record for the longest time spent at the highest altitude without the aid of artificial breathing equipment. Climbed a couple of mountains in the Himalayas. He was quite an interesting character.
What did he say about liberty?
What he said about liberty is that it is our right and duty to embrace liberty with both its promise and its responsibilities. Aleister Crowley understood that freedom ain't free. You know, it was the deepest need of the human soul was the exploration of liberty, but that it was also our deepest duty to accept the constraints of liberty, because liberty is only possible for a disciplined human being. And without that self-discipline, you know, liberty becomes license, and liberty and license are two very different things.
Let's get back to your work now, the Temple of Solomon, and you start from ancient Israel to secret societies as well. Where do you see the society going today, James? What's going to happen?
Well, you know, I'm deeply concerned. I see two very different strands developing in our world. at one point there's a kind of independence. There's a seeking after truth, seeking after the message of the Constitution and that kind of freedom, the republic, the concept of an informed and enlightened citizenry of independent beings who are working in concert with one another to build a society that is filled with opportunity for each, so that you know, people can kind of exploit the beauty of the human experience. On the other hand, I see a very strong collectivist influence that is harped on endlessly by the media and politicians, seeking to create a dependency. This drives me crazy, because a dependent people is a slave population, whether they're in chains of iron or in chains of thought.
Or being kept in fear.
Or being kept in fear and ignorance. You know, it's pernicious, it's frightening, and it's growing every single day. The very means of human liberation, things like television, computers, you know, the internet, are all being manipulated to kind of give a message to keep us in darkness. It's a profoundly disappointing thing. Shows like your own, where people are encouraged to hear different points of view and think outside the box. This is, you know, you're doing the great work here, my friend. I appreciate your efforts.
Well, we're going to keep it up. We didn't talk a lot about Freemasons. Tell me about that as a secret society.
Well, you know, the Freemasons are a product of the Enlightenment to such a great extent. I mean, it's really wonderful. They started out, of course, you know, as builders during the Middle Ages. Now, some of the legends of Freemasonry trace them back to ancient Egypt and the beginning, literally, the Garden of Eden. Some of it goes back to Solomon's Temple. They say that Freemasonry was founded by Solomon. Some Freemasons say that Solomon founded Freemasonry and that it was Freemasons who actually built the temple. But in historical times, at least, we see a tremendous amount of construction going on during the Middle Ages. And that was a time when people were limited in their motion and you know, restricted to their place of origin, you know, by the feudal system of the day, except for those who were builders and who had the kind of experience and knowledge that allowed them to travel freely through the various territories of Europe of the time and engage in this massive construction project of the hundreds of churches that were built during that period. These guys, mostly men, these guys were making their own rules, were living in their own communities, were responsible for their own endeavors. They had a certain kind of government. They were really outside the normal reach of feudal society, and they began to form what later became a middle class, you know, the artisans and craftsmen, architects and designers, laborers. They were the first labor union, true union, where people were protected from injury and given old age pensions and given health benefits in return for their work, and at the same time given the opportunity to progress from you know, apprentice to journeyman to master, learning their craft and trade, building the buildings and developing a kind of camaraderie, a social interaction, you know, in these kind of foreign work sites where they would find themselves perhaps for years separated from their friends and families. So this was the beginning of you know, this secret society thing. What many people trace them back to the Knights Templar. You know, they say that the concept in Masonry of giving aid to one's brothers, of having the necessity of a belief in a higher power, but being free to keep that private, is something that may have come about because of the persecution that the Knights Templars endured in the early 14th century. A fugitive brotherhood, and you know, that somehow or other the collective experience of building the castles and fortifications throughout the Holy Land during the Crusades had given the Templars a fantastic architectural knowledge and database that they were able to share with European craftsmen and continue the work of this Gothic architecture and church building that extended through the Middle Ages.
What did they mean by 33 degrees? What was that?
Well, 33 is, of course, the number of vertebrae of the human spine. It's the number of years that Christ was alive on earth. It's the number of years that the Temple of Solomon stood unmolested before the first attack. You know, it's the triangle 3 by the magic number 11 extended. 33 is the highest degree of Freemasonry. You know, it represents the pinnacle of the order. You know, there are three formal degrees in Freemasonry, but then there are leader add-on degrees, and the highest is the 33rd, but it has a lot of mystical precedent.
Is it possible that those on the bottom of Freemasonry don't know really what's going on at the top?
You know, again, this is a kind of a conspiratorial question, and I realize that, you know, you're asking it for good reason, but I would say, you know, there are a lot of secrets in Freemasonry, and the most important are concerned with, you know, what is the derivation of Masonic knowledge? I don't think, you know, when you look at Freemasonry, you're looking at a lot of really wonderful charitable activity. You're looking at construction and building activity. I don't see them as the kind of group who could do something like foment an American Revolution as they did in the late 18th century. Freemasons were a big part of it then, but now I think they're a pretty benign society, primarily engaged in charitable and fraternal activities. And I think that, you know, if you want to learn about Freemasonry, the place to look is someone like Albert Pike, who talks about the spiritual implications and the derivation from ancient mystery traditions, philosophies, astronomical knowledge, and this kind of hermetic core that most Freemasons are not aware of. So I would say that, you know, the real truth of Freemasonry is most Freemasons don't have the slightest idea what it's about.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. James, where do we get your book, The Temple of Solomon?
Well, certainly you can order it from Amazon. You can order signed copies from my website, jameswassermanbooks.com. You can order it from innertraditions.com and hopefully Barnes & Noble and many bookstores. It can be ordered very easily. It's widely distributed and available wherever fine books are sold.
Super. Well, stay with us, James. We're going to come back with you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we will take final phone calls now. So don't touch your dial. Get ready to make the phone call. We'll be back.